Well, I'm sure you're aware there's a big difference between men and women. Someone has come up with these particular insights. The difference between men and women: a man will pay £2 for a £1 item he wants, but a woman will pay £1 for a £2 item she doesn't want. A woman worries about the future until she gets a husband. A man never worries about the future until he gets a wife. A successful man is one who makes more money than his wife can spend. A successful woman is one who can find such a man. To be happy with a man, you must understand him a lot and love him a little. To be happy with a woman, you must love her a lot and try not to understand her at all. Any married man should always forget his mistakes. After all, there's no point two people remembering them. Men wake up as good looking as when they went to bed. Women somehow deteriorate during the night. A woman marries a man expecting he will change, but he doesn't. A man marries a woman expecting she won't change, and she does. A woman has the last word in any argument. Anything after that is the start of a new argument. There are two times when a man doesn't understand a woman: before marriage and after marriage. Well, men and women are different, and as the saying goes, viva la difference. A movie producer once asked the actor Spencer Tracy why he insisted in all his films having top billing over his co-actress Katharine Hepburn. The producer said to him, "After all, she's a woman, you're a man, ladies first." Spencer Tracy replied, "This is a movie, not a lifeboat." Now, the respective roles of men and women have long been debated, whether in movies, in lifeboats, or in church. And in this chapter, we're going to look at what the Apostle Paul says on matters of gender, certain roles or practices within the local church. Now, I want you to note that 1 Corinthians chapter 11 to chapter 14, we have a brand new section of this letter. So we're entering a brand new section. In these four chapters, the Apostle Paul's concern is this: how God's people conduct themselves in the local church. In fact, in those three chapters, 11 to 14, the word church, the ecclesia, appears 13 times. So it's talking about a church setting. And in these four chapters, there are three primary issues that the apostle wants us to learn about. Gender distinction here in chapter 11, 2 to 16. The differences between men and women. Next week, you'll look at the Lord's Supper, chapter 11, 17 to 34. And then in chapters 12 to 1 to 14, 40, we're going to look at spiritual gifts. So Paul is writing this new section about three areas of church life: gender distinction, the Lord's Supper, spiritual gifts. One of the big problems in this church was disorder in public meetings. We've commented in previous weeks that it was the local church, and only the local church in the Roman Empire, that welcomed all people, regardless of nationality, social status, a person's sex or economic position. The one place everyone was equal, slave and master, was in the local church. Women and slaves, who were treated as second-class citizens in society, were on a level playing field in the local church. They were valued just as the men. But there were some who misused this newfound freedom. They took it to excess. Someone has said that a new movement often suffers more from its own disciples than its enemies. And that was true of Corinth. You'll see next week, they misrepresented the Lord's Supper. They abused it. When it came to spiritual gifts, they abused, they misrepresented the gifts. They saw them as toys to play with rather than tools to build each other up with. And here in this chapter, there were ladies who had misused their freedom. And so the apostle now addresses these three issues one by one. Now there's a key thought, and don't miss this, because this is parallel to the whole of this chapter. And the key thought is headship. Headship. Look at verse 3. Honour your head. Honour your head. I want you to realise that the head of every man is Christ, the head of every woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. The key thought in the passage, he set the tone there in verse 3, is headship. So don't get sidetracked by other issues. The key thought is headship. We'll try and deal with the other issues as they come up. Now, when the Apostle Paul uses the word head in this chapter, he's primarily talking about that hairy round object that sits on top of your shoulders. The round lump that I'm looking at now. The head, of course, is the control centre of the body. We all know that if you damage your head, it will affect how your body operates. And if your head is severed, then you will die. The head is essential. It runs the body. It is in charge of the body. It is the organiser, the leader, the direction setter for the body. And everyone has a head. Some of you are pretty. Some of you are very pretty. You've all got a head. Even Mr. F, look at that head on him. Not saying he was an ugly baby, but I'm told that when he was born, the midwife slapped his parents. I'm not saying he was an ugly baby, but I'm told they put him into an incubator with tinted glass. And I'm not saying he was an ugly baby, but I'm told that his mother preferred to pull him rather than push him. But those are just rumours, okay? You've all got a head. They are essential. Now, from the physical head, and that's the word he's used to start with, he uses it then metaphorically, as an illustration, as a symbol. And he talks about headship. Just as the physical head controls the physical body, that same principle applies, headship in relationships, and three relationships are mentioned. And the first thing I want to draw to your attention is this. He says, honour your head for the sake of biblical teaching. That's verses 3-6. Honour your head for the sake of biblical teaching. And the biblical teaching is this, verse 3, how God has ordained certain things. Now the word head primarily means leadership, guidance, supervision. And the Apostle Paul says, just as Christ as the Son acknowledges the headship of God the Father, the leadership, the guidance, the supervision of the Father, Christian men should also acknowledge the headship of Christ, his supervision, his guidance, his leadership. And Christian women should acknowledge the headship of men, their husbands, the leadership, the guidance, and the supervision of men. Now, the headship distinction does not imply superiority for one, inferiority for the other. It doesn't carry that meaning whatsoever. We know that God the Father and God the Son are equal in every way. To quote, the members of the Trinity are co-equal and co-eternal, one in essence, nature, power, action, and will. And as the Athanasian Creed puts it, which was around from the 6th century, the Father is uncreated, the Son is uncreated, the Holy Spirit is uncreated, and all three are eternal without beginning. So headship does not mean one is superior and the other is inferior, because Jesus is not inferior to the Father. So it never carries that meaning of superiority and inferiority. And therefore it doesn't mean that in a relationship between a husband and the wife. We're not talking superiority or inferiority. And when Jesus was on planet Earth, of course, he modelled for us how this works out. God's way of leadership and headship and our way. Remember in Mark 10, 42-45, we've looked at it over the past few weeks. Jesus calls his disciples together. And he said, you know the rulers of the world lord it over people. The officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus taught that headship, that leadership, is not dictatorship, it is servanthood. It's not dictatorship, it is servanthood. It's not looking out for your own good, it's looking out for the good of others. And Jesus always put his Father first. I haven't come to do my will, he said, but my Father's will who sent me. So even though he was equal with God, he chose to recognise the leadership, the supervision, the guidance of the Father. And likewise, men are called to submit to Christ, to put him first in every area. That means to live sacrificially for the good of others. We're not lording over others. We live in submission to Christ. We're there as his servants, to serve others. And again, in a similar vein, we're told that the head of a woman is man. Married women are called to submit to their husbands. Again, I remind you, it's not dictatorship. It is servanthood. Not looking out for your good, but for the good of the others. Providing leadership, guidance, supervision. Now, of course, for a home, for a church to function properly, then there must be some kind of order. And order necessitates, it involves headship. And remember that leadership and quality are two different things. Leadership and quality are two different things. For example, in the army, you might have a general and you might have a private. One seems to have a higher rank than the other. The general could be a rotten individual with no morals and an evil, wicked man. The private might be a good, godly man. He's got the quality, the other one has the rank. So leadership and quality are two different things. I may be the head of the Curly household. Doesn't mean I'm the most spiritual. I would confess openly, my wife is probably a much better Christian than I am. A more godly person. She's got the quality, but God has put me in that situation where I am the head. I am the supervisor, the guider, the leader in that family. So headship is not dictatorship. And it doesn't necessarily mean whoever the head of the family is, they are the most qualified. But this is the way, according to verse 3, according to these verses, God has ordained it in his word. Now, let's move on to verse 4 and 6. Having explained what the principle of headship is, the Apostle Paul now talks about the outworking of headship in the context of praying and prophesying in public. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. Every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is the same as having her head shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, she might as well have her hair cut off. But if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, then she should cover her head. Now, in understanding and applying these verses, context is essential. It always is. Any part of scripture, take a text out of its context and you're left with a con. These verses were primarily written to the Corinthian church. We noted in chapters 8 to 10 that things recorded there primarily were for the Corinthian church. He talked about, and we looked 3 chapters on food and idol worship. Most of us probably came along and said, what's this got to do with me? I don't worship idols. I don't offer food to idols. But we looked at it. It had a primarily application for the Corinthians, but there were principles in it we could apply for ourselves. So it wasn't just dead text. It was primarily to help the Corinthians, but there were lessons to learn for you and I. And likewise with this chapter, we're going to, for consistency, take the same look at it. I believe primarily what Paul says here was for the Corinthians. But it has many a point, many an application for us today. So we're going to ask 2 questions. What did it mean for the first century Corinthians? And then we'll ask the question, well, what does it mean for us today? And we'll dwell more on this first point because this kind of sets the foundation for the other points. What did it mean for the first century Corinthians? Well, remember, the Apostle's Paul concern is the local church. He's talking about Christians meeting together in an orderly way and females, ladies, wives, taking part publicly. He says to these Corinthian Christians, in order for the church to function in that capacity, a woman should wear a head covering and a man should not. That was the application he gave to the Corinthians 2,000 years ago. Just use your imagination. Imagine you're a man. You go back in time 2,000 years and you attend this church in Corinth. As you enter through the doors, you have a head covering, a shawl around your shoulders. Jewish men wore them, pagan men wore them. You walk into the service, you sit there, and someone says, "Oh, let's pray." And the moment someone starts to pray, you pull the shawl up over your head. Or I invite someone out of the congregation to pray, and they come and they put a shawl over their head. Now, you would shock the congregation. Because they would say, "Hold on, isn't he a Christian? Why is he wearing a head covering?" That's what they do in the pagan temple. That's a sign of idolatrous worship. Aren't we set free from that? Aren't we Christians? Why is he wearing a head covering when he's worshipping the Christian God? Men didn't cover their heads in the church at Corinth. They were different to the society around them. Now, remember who's teaching this and saying a man shouldn't wear a head covering. It is Rabbi Saul, the Apostle Paul. All his life, whenever he prayed, he pulled a head covering, a shawl, a prayer shawl over his head. No Orthodox male Jew ever read the scripture or ever prayed without covering their head. But it is the Apostle Paul who says men shouldn't wear a head covering when they pray, even though he'd done it all his life. Why not? Because he's not in Jerusalem, he's in Corinth. In Jerusalem, that might be accepted because no one would misunderstand it. But in Corinth, putting a shawl on your head has wider implications. He's in a totally different culture. And so he says, don't do it. Many a missionary has found that what is acceptable to wear in the pulpit in England is not acceptable to wear in other countries. One dress code suits one culture, but it doesn't transfer to another. And it's interesting that nowhere in the New Testament does Paul ever correct the situation of Jewish converts. He never tells them not to wear a head covering. But on this occasion, he does. We never read him saying, "Guys, take those yarmulkes off. Get rid of your hats and give them to your wife." He never said that. But on this occasion, he does. Because in this culture at this time, it was applicable. Campbell Morgan, one of my favourite preachers, said this, that Christians do not build doctrine on "it is written." Campbell Morgan said, Christians build their doctrine on "it is written," and again, "it is written," and again, "it is written." In other words, if it is a key truth, God will repeat it in other letters. And you know it is a key doctrine and you hold on to it. If it is only mentioned once, you have to say, well, why? And if you look at the cults, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Christadelphians, they build their doctrines on isolated texts and verses. Now, that's the man who walks into a church. He's told, take your head covering off, because you'll be misunderstood and thought to be an idol worshipper. Imagine you're a Christian woman. You go back 2,000 years in time. You enter this church at Corinth not wearing a head covering. And a head covering was a shawl or a scarf. Not a hat. Nowhere in the chapter is the word hat mentioned. It was something to cover the entire head. You're hiding your hair. And as the woman entered the church in Corinth without a head covering, she too sent out a message to those who saw her. Remember, Corinth was an immoral city. And the only people in Corinth who didn't wear a veil, a head covering, in a public situation were the prostitutes. And not only the prostitutes, they were temple prostitutes. They were linked to worship. If you went to the temple, the women there, or there were thousands of them who were temple prostitutes. So to not wear a head covering, you were automatically linked to a loose values, an immoral individual. So it was a disgrace not to wear a head covering, because you would bring shame on your husband and your family, because people would look at you and say, look at her, she's a loose woman, she's available for hire. I suppose the equivalent today is if a lady came in here dressed in certain clothing, and you'd say, gosh, she looks like a prostitute. Look at what she's wearing. Her clothes is conveying a message. She may be a good individual, but her clothes is communicating one message. Her individual inside you can't read. And so by entering the church service without a head covering at Corinth, you sent out a message. And that's true today. In the summertime, you ladies, if you came in without a cardigan or shawl and you had bare shoulders, if I transported you to the Middle East, they would be scandalised by that. Bare shoulders in a church setting. Don't you know where you are? But in this country, we come in shorts and short skirts and tops that don't have sleeves in, because it's acceptable in our culture, but it's not in the Middle Eastern culture. So Paul brings these arguments together. He says the key verse is verse 3, honouring your head. And then he explains these other details. Here's the second point. He says, honour your head for the sake of creation. Verse 7 to 12. A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But the woman is the glory of man. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Now in these verses, the Apostle Paul doesn't argue his understanding of headship from local customs or culture. The teaching on headship now goes all the way back to creation. He says headship has been true ever since God created the world. God's order of headship is based on the fact man was created by God for God, and the woman was created from man for man. Now again, priority does not infer or imply inferiority. And you can see that in verse 11 to 12, where he says they're mutually dependent upon each other. Whenever I conduct a wedding, I nearly always in my sermon quote Matthew Henry. Matthew Henry made a very famous quote, and it was this. He said, women were created from the rib of man to be beside him, not from his head to top or to rule him, not from his feet to be trampled on by him, but under his arm to be protected by him, near to his heart to be loved by him. And as you read Genesis creation narratives, they clearly show that both men and women are equal and yet different. They both bear the image and the glory of God. Both men and women were given that command to reproduce and rule. Both were allowed to eat from every tree apart from one. And we see clearly Adam and Eve created equal, but also different. Male and female, he created them. And inferiority is nowhere in the text, so don't read it in the text. And yet within the context of male and female's equality, God assigned them different roles. He made Adam first, and from Adam he created Eve to be his helper. Genesis 2:18. The first description of a woman is this. It's not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him. Does suitable helper imply that the woman was somehow inferior or a servant of the man? No, it doesn't. Helper, this first descriptive word for a woman, does not come from the Hebrew word meaning doormat. The Hebrew word translated as helper is the same word God uses to describe himself throughout the Old Testament. So helper does not presume lesser authority. The woman could help the man. She was equal in lots of ways, but she worked in cooperation or in submission to him. So spiritual headship has been true since the creation of the world, says Paul. And then in verse 10, you have one of the most difficult verses in the Bible. He said it's for this reason that a woman ought to have authority on her head, because of the angels. And I haven't found anyone who can explain what that means in my research. If you've come up with anyone who can explain it, please email me or let me know. I'm not going to give you an interpretation of verse 10 in a couple of minutes. I will say this in passing. He's talking about praying and prophesying. They are giving messages, aren't they? When you pray, you're given a message to God. If you prophesy, you're given a message to other Christians. So the context is message. The word angel literally means message, a messenger, someone who brings a message. Hebrews 1:14 says, are not all angels ministering spirits? In other words, they minister, but the whole of Hebrews, especially chapter 1, says they only minister under authority. They're under the Son. And it may well be that the Apostle Paul is encouraging women to worship, but he says have the same submissive attitude that angels have. And the bottom line again is, remember who your head is and honour your head. And then in verse 11, 12, submission is not inferiority. As again you see, that woman came from man, he says, and then he reverses it. But ever since, man has come from woman. There's an independence there, there's an equality there. Thirdly, verse 13 to 15, he says, honour your head for the sake of nature. Honour your head for the sake of nature. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is for her glory. For long hair is given to her as a covering. Now, notice those first three words. In case you missed them, I'm going to say them again. Judge for yourselves. That is emphatic in the Greek text. It's almost kind of in capital letters, underlined, highlighted, shouting out at you. Judge for yourselves. See, that gives me a bit of respite. Because the emphasis is on you, not the preacher. And those three words are a reminder that you have to do your own thinking. You have to respond accordingly. I can't do it for you. You must make up your own judgment. And he says to his readers, ask yourself, what is the cultural norm? And then figure out for yourself how you apply it. And to help you figure it out, he says in verse 14 to 15, look at nature. Actually, it's not the word for the natural world or for Mother Nature. By nature, he's talking about the culture he's in. It's often translated instinct. We would say, what is your gut feeling? Look around and what does your gut feeling tell you about hair? Well, look around the room. Most men have got shiny tops, and most women have got a good head of hair. They have a covering, whereas most men don't. But can I remind you, ladies, you don't put marble tops on cheap furniture, all right? So he says, use your gut instinct, look around, and that will give you an idea of what is appropriate, and then apply it to your cultural setting. And then, fourth and finally, he says, honour your head for the sake of apostolic authority. If anyone wants to be contentious about this, boy, I bet there's a few who want to be contentious about what I've said this morning. If you want to be argumentative, he says, well, we, talking about what the other apostles do, have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. So in his final argument of the four, he says, as an apostle, this is what I'm saying. I'm not going to argue with you. This is what God says. Now, what or where these other churches are is open to debate. Some people would say they are the other churches in the locality, in the Roman Empire. Others say, no, it applies to every church all over the world. I'm not sure which is best. Let me say in conclusion, in verse 2 and verse 16, to me they act as brackets, that the rest is in between. Scan them again. In verse 2, he talks about traditions, And in verse 16, he talks about practice, which is often translated custom. So he says, traditions and customs, and everything he said is between those two words, traditions and customs. For me, that helps me in my understanding to see that the physical wearing of a head covering was cultural. It's tradition, it's to do with custom. Now, ladies, if you read and interpret these verses differently, you want to wear a hat or a head covering, go ahead. And we respect you for doing it. But they're not easy verses, and different Christians will interpret them differently. Even in our own tradition, we are a Christian Brethren church. That's our roots and our heritage. There are other Christian Brethren churches in the area who interpret these verses very differently. Go down to Wasash Gospel Hall. The ladies there will all have a hat on, from the youngest to the oldest. Guarantee it. But strangely, they're not allowed to pray publicly. So there's an inconsistency there. Bitton Gospel Chapel, when they were open, if you went there, they arrived at the stage that ladies could pray publicly, but they had to pull a shawl over their heads when they did so. And then if they wanted to take it off, they could. That was their interpretation. Go to West End Chapel, another Christian Brethren church. The ladies will pray publicly with no head covering whatsoever. So you have three Brethren churches who all come from the same tradition, who interpret this chapter in three different ways. So it's not an easy chapter. So judge for yourselves, verse 13 says. Think it through and do what you think is right for your conscience and your culture. The man came in here this morning with a hat on, you wouldn't say idol worshipper. The lady came in the church this morning without a hat on, you wouldn't say loose woman. It's not appropriate for our culture, but it was in Corinth, and it may well be in places like Persia and Iran today. So judge for yourselves. And let me just finish by reminding you of the key principle, which is headship. Headship. And if I can put it crudely, a woman can wear a hat in church and the pants at home. And that misses the point entirely. So wives, please consider your relationship with your husband, and if you're acting in a way that undermines your husband, then rethink what you're doing. He is not necessarily more capable or better than you, but he is the head, the guider, the leader, the supervisor in that relationship. And most of the world will see your relationship in that light. Thus you demean yourself if you're dishonouring him. And husbands, please support your wife in her ministry. Sisters are not second-class Christians. They are fellow priests with a priestly ministry, the same as you. And we need to recognise and encourage gifting and ministry in our wives. Key thought, honour your head. Let's pray.